I am much aware that this is not your first retreat. But I do remember when I came back from my very first retreat, and I was living in London at the time. So I was returning from the retreat, and it's kind of in stages. You know, you first take the taxi, and then you get into the train, and then it was maybe the tube or the bus, and then I was home. And on the same, I think the same afternoon, I had to go to the supermarket. And I remember going with this shopping trolley, and I was bumping into things all the time. because my speed simply hadn't caught up with the rest of the world. So I'd like to remind you to be careful when you get out of here. And what I also kind of realized by hearing the phone, you know, is kind of, at the time that was actually, I think there were some mobile phones, but it was very unusual to have a mobile phone at the time. But it's kind of when we switch on the power button on our phones now, it's almost like the whole world comes back at once. Yeah, I had stages, you know, I could get used to, you know, coming from the countryside, getting more and more busy. But it's like if we switch on this little thingy and all of it, at least for some of us, our whole world comes back. So it was really an invitation to kind of be really kind, you know, and think about, you know, what you want to attend to and what you don't want to attend to for the next, maybe for today and also maybe for tomorrow. So there has been a lot of change since that time. This has been also my first time at IMS, and it has been quite an experience, and I think it will take me also some time to digest, I'm sure. I've taken notes about things, you know, I have to think of and remember. I mean, you couldn't see all the meetings I missed because they're not on the schedule, you know, because they're kind of some in-betweens for the teachers. So there's a whole different world, you know, that's going on behind, which I had to also get used to, you know, to juggle all of it. But you know, one thing, the place is very welcoming, but also here, it's for me, it's always so lovely. You know, we started off with the masks, and it was really difficult to get a sense of you. You know, I mean, I could feel you as a body. But then over time, you know, with the small groups and also taking off the masks, you know, you really you get to know the faces and you get to know the people and how they move and how they are. And that is always such a heart-opening experience on every retreat, you know, once you get closer to the people, you know. So thank you for all you were sharing in your small little groups and in small interviews. You know, this is actually, as a teacher, I don't know if it's for everyone, you know, this is really where you kind of feel the big connection, you know, and where you kind of really get the sense of what's happening for you, you know, and really makes it very meaningful to actually sit somehow in this place. So my whole experience is a really very warm and welcoming one. Also, of course, a lot of appreciation for my teachers that are supporting me and giving me also the opportunity and the space and the support and the time, you know. I mean, as a teacher, you always have a plan what you want to put through, you know, and every time you give some time away, you know, you have to let go of something. So I'm sure both my teachers had to do a bit of letting go there as well. So to all of you, you know, I wish you a wonderful and peaceful journey back into your lives, wherever you're going and whatever you're going to meet. And this, of course, this will have a very special place in my heart, you know, being the first time being here and all the experience that have been, all the waves that coming and going, you know, it's really highly appreciated. Yeah, thank you very much, everyone.
I have two pieces I wish to share. The one is, we haven't spoken much about integration of meditation into daily life, and I know this is a challenge and this is a task. And something in me balks at the idea that the vision of meditation has to be integrated into the sacrosanct parameters of the daily life, that has to, you know, remain unchallenged, and that is basically untouchable in its suchness, so that the practice has to live in there somehow without disrupting our daily life or our everyday life. So there's something slightly askew with this wanting to integrate practice into my daily life. In my books, it should be basically the other way around. Yeah, if I'm honest. If you allow me to say, to name four different dimensions, I think is important in contemplation. None of this is canonical, so take it with more than a pinch of salt. I think the first dimension, and they are not necessarily sequential, but it makes sense that they are stacked. So the first of this dimension has to do with the skill of settling, the skill of calming, the skill of soothing, the skill of down-regulating. The body, the mind, the affects, the movements, just the intensity, the speed, the throughput of our system. Yeah, just learning to pacify, tranquilize, soothe, stabilize, still, unify, profoundly settle. Yeah, settle the baby. Yeah, let's call that stage settle the baby. I do not see that this can be left out. So that would entail some continued attentional focusing exercises. It would entail some repetition. It would entail a kind of discipline, not so much in the rigor by which we focus, but the tenacious patience by which we come back to that focus from wherever the mind has a tendency to go to. Yeah. So the discipline is not in what I actually do in holding, but in my willingness and humbleness to come back to that place, because it is to be expected that much of my practice consists in not getting it. Yeah. That's what we don't say in our meditation brochures. That much of the practice consists that it doesn't work, you know, or it feels as if it doesn't work, that, you know, attention is meant to scan the horizons, you know, it's meant to, the mind is meant to wander. You know, there is no question about this, neurologically speaking, or, you know, from evolutionary psychology point of view, it's very clear that we need to have a scanning type of attention. At the same time, that first stage entails that we modulate that tendency to go out and disperse energy and actually gather, you know, this gathering, bringing in, and then lingering, hovering, dwelling, viharati, you know, basically staying with, learning to stay with. Stage two is also important, or the second dimension. This is the capacity to learn to disidentify. I'm never sure, is it de-identify or disidentify? Disidentify. I think de-identify has something to do with big data and making people anonymous. So sorry if I get this confused. So disidentify, that means learning to see that, yes, there is something happening, and yes, I am in some kind of stewarding relationship to that happening, but what is happening doesn't really belong to me. I'm not really the thing that happens. And the totality, both of the thing and the happening, doesn't constitute a self. Yeah? So neither the knowing constitutes a self, nor the known constitutes a self. So this identification, this famous step back, the capacity to see, yes, yeah. Aristotle puts it like that. He says it is the mark of an educated human. He may say man, but let's put it inclusively. the mark of an educated human being is to be able to hold a thought without taking sides on that thought. Yeah. I couldn't say that more elegantly and more simply. Yeah. So the capacity to see, yes, there is, yes, this is what it says, and yes, I don't have to be a partisan of either end of this. Yeah. So that capacity to move back in intentionality and in the non-appropriation of my experience, non-appropriating the thoughts, non-appropriating the emotions, not even appropriating the body and its states or sensations, is a powerful dimension of contemplative practice. Yes, there is, and no, it's not me. It doesn't mean I have not some kind of relationship with this or even some responsibility. Yeah. But there is, the relationship is not one of straight ownership. It's not one of a direct causal ownership is the word. So learning to find the courage to keep taking that step back widens the horizon. This is a powerful dimension of practice. Yeah. Creating the safety that comes from this, creating the de-dramatization that comes from this, creating the perspective that comes from this step back. It's powerful, getting off the stage, you know, into the audience, first on the floor and then up, further perspective. Something is being played, but I'm no longer out there strutting it. Yeah. So a powerful dimension. Once I have learned this, and to be honest with you, only once I have learned this becomes the next dimension possible. And this is that I carefully and respectfully, in negotiated ways, move back into the very things I have learned to disidentify from. Now, that third stage is very important. Meditators sometimes think it's important to be still and it's important to disidentify, and that's the job. Unfortunately, there is more to the contemplative path. By just learning how to still the mind, however useful and important this is, I do not actually resolve much. I just learn the skill of making myself still. Yeah? If I wanted to be critical, I would say this is palliative almost. Yeah? Unless I understand some of the dynamics that make my mind agitated, excited, besotted, anxious, making it topically still is better than not having this skill, but it also doesn't actually address the roots. Yeah. So the same holds true for the disidentification. The disidentification does not intrinsically resolve or liberate myself. It just makes me capable of going away further. Then the pressure of suffering decreases. My abilities increase. My perspective increases. But still, the roots are not necessarily addressed. So the third step actually is an inquiring step. It says, yes, I can stay out of trouble. And once I've learned to stay out of trouble, I'm actually going to look what troubles me. Yeah, I'm going back in, you know, with samadhi under my belt, with perspective in my heart. I go back in and see what really is there so disturbing, is there so exciting, is so confusing, is so anxiety-inducing. Is this really what it looks like? Can I go closer without losing my bearings? I begin to probe into, examine, investigate. I begin to figure out the dynamics that make this heart move. Yeah. This is invariably personal, psychological, highly subjective. It will involve some biographical work. It will involve finding out more about the conditions in which I have developed in the way I have developed. Yeah. And little by little I begin to unravel and understand, and also to liberate more of the potential that is in this being. Yeah. The third dimension can feel very personal. And that's where the fourth dimension is really crucial. That fourth dimension offers me a perspective on the personal that I have found out in my own path, in the unraveling of my own pain, my own conditioning, my own temperament. In the fourth dimension, I begin to see these things in non-personal terms anymore. I begin to recognize what I have gone through in other people. I begin to understand how this dynamics looks for another person. I begin to understand dynamics of conditionality, of freedom. I begin to understand the bigger picture of things. Yeah. And I learn to see the kind of, I get a map of what I have experienced in very personal terms, biographical terms and subjective terms, in a sort of broader spectrum of how growth and maturity and realization unfolds for not just this being, but for other beings as well. So in a way, this fourth dimension helps me to depersonalize some of the territory I have gone through, and I begin to recognize that territory in others where it may happen to show itself in different particulars. Yeah. So I think contemplative practice needs all four of these stages, and then we can get stuck. Yeah. We can get stuck. These stages also have their pathologies, at least the first three. So the pathology of the first one would be, I'm not still enough, you know. I'm never still enough, you know. I've never really met people who feel they have enough samadhi, you know. People who have really excellent samadhi still feel they somehow don't quite have enough samadhi. So the idea that you have to be more still before any of the other stuff can be of any interest or use to you is probably not a good assessment. Yeah. The pathology of the second one would be, you know, you want more control. Yeah. The thing has to be, you have to be even more removed, and the temptation is the farther you are removed from the problem, the less the incentive is to resolve the problem. Yeah. But that only works as long as you go away. As soon as you come back, the problem reconstitutes. Yeah. That's what Gerrit speaks of when she speaks of the phone. Yeah. Some of the problem reconstitutes as soon as you switch the thing on, or as soon as you go back into relationship from a place of quiet and regular life on retreat. So we constellate, we begin to exchange, we rub up. And that needs holding very carefully, this going in and going out. The resolution cannot be that I just go out and stay out. Yeah. That cannot be the resolution. Yeah. The pathology of the third would be something like over-dramatization. You know, there's always some consciousness orphan to be found and rescued, and some inner child to be helped and understood, and some, you know, there's always more of stuff. You know, there is an endlessness of stuff. I mean, even if you're had a great childhood, there will be stuff there that can feel endless. So there may be a reluctance to leave that territory because it somehow offers drama. You know, it offers, at least something is happening, you know. It's painful and it's dramatic and it's full of sad and wild stuff. But something is happening, and I'm in it. You know, it's working. You know, because so much stuff is happening. So there may be a tendency to over-identify with the drama, with the action, with the sparks that fly, with, you know, the intensity of stuff. So intensity. I don't know if you have a mind like mine, intensity can be quite hypnotic. So some of us feel drawn to whatever is intense, somehow holds more reality. But that's not necessarily true. Yeah, that's not necessarily true. I'm yet thinking of a pathology for the fourth one. Maybe an over fondness of map making. So I probably tick that box. Yeah. So ponder when you think about your practice of meditation. Ponder whether these are there somewhere, these dimensions, whether you can find them. And if you notice a consistent statement that something is not enough and the rest cannot be engaged with before your sense of enough is somehow met, maybe this put a little question mark there, just a little question mark. I'm grateful for this course. It's been deep and great. I've been here the first time after 2019, and it's a delight and humbling. I've learned a lot from all of you. I deeply, more than I can say, appreciate your candor and your heartfulness, your willingness to share and to run with this. You know, that's one of the most rewarding things, to see people take something serious that is deeply meaningful to me and run with it and make something of it and come back at me with stuff they have found. Yeah, this is really rewarding. Some of that stuff is not necessary. It doesn't have to be flattering. I still, admittedly, I prefer the flattery part. But I'm not even sure whether that is the most important part. Yeah. So I want to thank my team, who I've learned from both of them. And I appreciate. I actually enjoyed large parts of this. Yeah. Secretly, quietly, in my own ways. So sometimes, you know, in between our meeting an institution, meeting a new team, meeting a group of people, and meeting a reconfigured IMS after the pandemic, a couple of things have changed. Maybe not so much in here, but, you know, a substantial part of the institution and some of the protocols and ways of doing things. Many of the team are new to me. So, in between all that, I've actually had many happy moments. Yeah. Thank you for your heartfulness.
This morning I was taking some time to reflect on this transition, because I find for myself this transition from kind of, as I like to say, this retreat to the real retreat is so significant. And like both Garrett and Akinchino were sharing, I think the other thing that I started to sense into was also my experience with all of you. And just feeling how my heart has been so touched. And I think the word that comes of how it was touched is it's been tenderized. It's so tender now. And as a result of that, I just want to share my appreciation and gratitude for this opportunity to get to practice together with all of you in this role. It means a lot to me. And it gives me hope for this troubled world. So thank you. Thank you for your efforts in terms of that. Also, what arose was just some reflections on transition, having to navigate this transition. And one thing that came to mind is I remember I was doing this month-long retreat with this teacher, Saita Uvivekananda. And we were having these practice discussions with Sayadaw, I think most days, so it was like 6 days out of the week where you'd have the practice, your individual practice discussions. But they're done in a very funky way. Let me just put it that way. So somebody's having, you're having your practice discussion, and before you're done with your practice discussion, it's kind of jarring. He'll ring the bell, and he'll be like, go on. So you're continuing to share what's going on, but as you're doing that, the practice discussion is ending, and the other person is coming up right next to you and doing their bows, the next person that's going to have their practice discussion. So they're hearing the tail end of your practice discussion, no matter what's going on. Like if I'm having like an emotionally overwhelming connection with Sayadaw Vivekananda, there's somebody's coming up, doing their bows. And then Sayadaw begins the practice discussion with the other person while you're doing your bows. So you get this kind of this interesting thing where you get to hear sometimes the beginnings and endings of each other's practice discussions. So in the midst of this, and sometimes I have to say I learned more from others' practice discussion than my own. So in this strange, funky way of doing practice discussions, I remember I was coming up slowly and doing my bows to Sayadaw. And there is a practitioner, oh, so moving, of sharing, you know, I just have this aspiration. I've been moved by the Dharma, or this is what's resonating for me, but I feel like I'm going to lose it in some way. And I loved what the Sayadaw said. He was, he said, you know, because it's towards the end of the retreat, he said, sometimes towards the end of the retreat, it can be really wonderful just to place an aspiration or place an intention in your heart. And then that's it. Just allow that, because he really felt like the heart had been, as I was saying, like tenderized, open in a way, and to place something in there, it's like the ground is fertile for that seed to grow. And it was quite striking. I bumped into this practitioner probably 2 or 3 years after this, and we were just talking about that retreat. And she shared with me how that particular sprout had grown in her life. Really, her whole life kind of moved in this particular way. And I got inspired by this, and I remember doing this on a month-long retreat. I was doing a month-long retreat, this was years after this, a loving-kindness retreat, where I was just spending the entire month of the retreat practicing loving-kindness. And I spent a lot of time, especially the latter part of that month-long, and it was a particular way of doing it, going through these categories, of working with my difficult person. And it was so cool. I got to this point where it was just, I could feel them exit the difficult person category. You know, it was like, oh, wow, you're like, I feel like I'm in this place. I can love you no matter what. It was really powerful. And I remember having this aspiration, because I knew I was going to be interacting with this individual afterwards. And, you know, I kind of felt like, oh, you know, I feel like I've been misperceiving this person, that I had these notions that they were more trouble than they really were. And then I went, there was a transition, like you're going through, and I think the next day or the second day, I got back to my community, and this fellow, he was in a kind of an adjacent sangha. And when I got back, there was this entire meltdown going on around his unethical behavior, and people were wanting me to deal with it. So I want to say, like, just to be honest, like, the loving no matter what just wasn't there for this person. Right? It would, like, it had drained the tank in, like, just a few minutes of that, just to be honest with you. Nonetheless, yet even it felt like that my aspiration had been shattered. And this is really important, I think, with holding an aspiration. I could see my mind coming back to that, and it softening in the midst of that. And that was so important. It was a super difficult situation. I had to have conversations with this individual, and also they were connected with another monastery and kind of let the monastery know of these particular behaviors. It was tough. And yet I felt like I showed up for it differently. And yeah, there was a phase of like damn it, this dude ruined my aspiration. I felt like I was in this like sweet space. So I'm just sharing that, like, and I'm not saying that, you know, your unfolding of your aspiration will be kind of disastrous the way it is for me at times. But even when those things happen, it doesn't mean that that everything, if you place an aspiration, that it's destroyed in some way. But there's something powerful about that, about just placing something. And in just a minute, I'm going to have us bring our attention inward and to get a feeling sense of the aspiration or intention that you want to place in your heart, not the expectation. Did you hear how there was expectation in mind? To be sensitive to that. It's just, and it can be, you know, something simple about something you want to carry forward from this retreat that you want to allow to shape your life or to inform your life. It can be to pause, or the general thing of to love, or to soften. Now, what's that for you? So in light of this, if you just need to take a minute to stand up and just move your body a little bit, just so there can be a sense of comfort when we bring our attention inward. So do feel free to kind of move the body a little bit. We'll just take a minute so that there can be some ease and sometimes even bringing the energy up a little bit. So let's just take 1 minute here. Okay, so when you're ready, finding a posture that feels supportive. And I invite you to begin just by feeling the body, the whole body, whatever posture it's in. Allowing for ease, for relaxation. And then beginning to invite to come into the heart right now, that aspiration, that intention that begins to form at the end of this retreat in your heart. It might be an image, it might be a feeling. It might be a combination of those. I'm beginning to find the word or the words that might capture some of that feeling sense of your aspiration or intention or what wants you? What's there that wants you to carry it forward? And when you get a sense of that, what can help is it's like honoring it, like letting it know that you're hearing its wisdom that it's offering you. Kind of respect. And then sometimes what I do is to allow for some kind of image or felt sense of now, like planting it in the heart. It's like you're allowing it to be planted there in your heart, where it has a home. And if it fits, to maybe imagine covering it with soil, moisture, so that it's planted there in the heart. And then noticing how that feels in the body right now, to have this aspiration planted there in your heart. So may it be so. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to do this. And may our seeds grow together as we leave this retreat. Yeah, thank you for that.
So now towards the end, we also would like to remember that all the good that has been done here, we would like to spread it a bit into the world. I'd like to read a poem by a Swedish poet, Thomas Tranströmer, of, in a sense, what we're trying to do here. Two truths approach each other. One comes from inside, the other from outside. And where they meet, we have a chance to catch sight of ourselves. The person who sees what's about to take place cries out wildly, "Stop! Anything, if only I don't have to know myself." An abode exists that wants to tie up on shore. It's trying right here. In fact, it will try thousands of times yet. Out of the darkness of the woods, a long boat hook appears, pokes in through the open window, in among the guests who are getting warm dancing. So, we are here on a journey to get to know each other, inside and outside, and as we, in a sense, learn about ourselves, you know, that kind of also opens up to that we can be differently, live differently, act differently outside in the world. The woman that gave this tangerine to me in India, you know, to a certain degree, this small act of kindness is still with me. It's still here. It's still in this room. So we never know what kind of small acts, however small, what kind of effect they can have on the world and on our surroundings. So however small, however little, yeah, sometimes we think, oh, it's just me, you know, and I can't really do much. But every little thing, you know, everything we pass on has some effect in this kind of world. So we're not just practicing and doing this for ourselves. We're really trying to make and bring change into the outer world. So for the benefit of all beings, without exception, throughout this and all my lifetimes, I dedicate myself to the practice and realization of awakening until we all together reach this spiritual goal. May you all be well.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.